You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us.
Hi, I'm Annie from the USA.
And I'm Johanna from Austria, and you are listening to your favorite international podcast. The podcast with two catfishes catfishing each other.
Meow. No, we're not doing that. I'm not doing that. She might. Who can say? Stay tuned.
You never know.
Yeah. If you're new here, we are friends who met online one day back in 2018 playing a mobile game. Mm-hmm. And pretty quickly, our chat went from game chat to murder chat. And
that's true.
We decided it would be fun to start a podcast. And that's what we've been doing for 3 years now. And we keep doing it because of you. We just have the best listeners ever, honestly. Thank you so much for all of your support and downloads, ratings, reviews, and messages. Just thank you. We appreciate it. Please make sure that you send us your story for the Halloween listener story episode, you know, our annual Halloween episode. We love this episode. You have until the end of September to tell us your spookiest experiences. We want to know about your experience with the paranormal, with the afterlife, spiritualism, cryptozoology, ever get a really good palm reading? Does your uncle have a ghost in his house? We want to know. Tell us all of it, please.
Yes, we really want to hear it. Please send us your message via email to freshhellpodcast@gmail.com. Tell us how you like to be called, like anonymous, I don't know, whatever your name is, or make up some cool alibi. Alias. Make up some cool alias.
Alias. We don't need an alibi.
Not yet. And, of course, we also want to give a huge shout-out to our newest Patreon members, and they are Stacy Joswiak and Andrea Wolfing. That's a German name. I can pronounce that.
I like it. Those are two good names. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I think that's it for now. And let's get into today's episode.
Yeah, I do want to warn everyone, this one is gross. This is a... just a content warning. Maybe don't eat lunch while listening to this one. Okay? All right.
Might be smart, yeah.
Yeah.
So, we heard about horrible murders of young people in the last 2 weeks from Annie.
Oh, so awful.
So we thought it's time for a bit of a macabre palate cleanser. I don't know if it will be exactly funny, but it will be interesting. Lots of history there. Definitely interesting. We thought it's time for a bit more of medical history. You know, we did episode 90, Sticks and Stones May Break Your Bones, where we dove into some of the more disturbing early forms of medical treatment. We all know now where the term blowing smoke up someone's ass comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And this week we thought we could tell you some of the most disturbing firsts, or maybe not firsts, in the history of surgery.
So disturbing.
The thing is, at first it's always like this. We thought, oh, we're gonna, you know, tell you 4 to 6 interesting stories of surgeries, and then we keep researching, and it's like, well,
hang on, yeah.
Yeah, there's so much that we want to tell you, so it's not 4 to 6, but it's 2 or 3 surgeries. It's good, trust us.
You were setting you up for some real disappointment. Get ready. No, it's gonna be good. You're gonna love it.
So, where should we start? How about a quick overview on the history of surgery in general?
I think that's good. All right. I think first we should all see what the exact definition of surgery is, just to make sure we're all on the same page. Britannica.com defines surgery as follows, quote, "Surgery, branch of medicine that is concerned with the treatment of injuries, diseases, and other disorders by manual and instrumental means. Surgery involves the management of acute injuries and illnesses as differentiated from chronic, slowly progressing diseases, except when patients with the latter type of disease must be operated upon." End quote. Then we have the Cambridge Dictionary, which says, quote, "The treatment of injuries or diseases by cutting open the body and removing or repairing the damaged part or an operation of this type." Or it also says, an occasion when a medical operation involving cutting open the body is performed on someone, the treatment of injuries or diseases in people or animals by cutting open the body and removing or repairing the damaged part. End quote.
It's a lot of cutting.
Yeah, cutting you open, fixing something, or attempting to. It is assumed that ever since mankind developed tools, they probably tried to perform simple surgeries. Maybe not so simple ones. Who knows what kind of great ideas they had while sitting around the fireplace? Would it be a fireplace, or is it like just a fire pit?
Yeah, fire pit probably.
Yeah.
Around the fire.
Somewhere around the fire. We just don't really know what kind of surgery really was the first one, because it could have been something like cutting open a cyst in order to drain pus from an infection, and there's not going to be any evidence left of that. The earliest evidence of surgeries that we have now is that of trepanation and amputation. The first amputation that we know of was done more than 30,000 years ago in Borneo. A person had the lower third of his left leg removed, and they survived the surgery and lived for another 6 to 9 years.
It's fascinating.
Right? And we mentioned trepanation already in the Sticks and Stones episode. This is a method where holes are drilled or scraped into the skull. And can you imagine the noise? Just the... Yeah. No, thank you. In order to release pressure in the brain. We're not going to get too much into detail in that today, though, because we have other things to talk about. And as we said, we already talked about this in episode 90. So we thought it would be fun to talk about those moments in history where surgeries happen that will make you go, oh boy, you know, hang on, what happened? Or worse, some of them are worse.
Yeah, it's more like, ugh.
It's, yeah, Johanna has some pretty gruesome details for us. Ooh. All right, I'm ready.
Okay, so I would love to start with the French king, Louis XIV, Louis XIV, the Sun King, the Great, l'état, c'est moi. So Louis was on the French throne from 1643 until his death in 1715 at the age of almost 77. Louis was destined for exceptional greatness. Everybody knew so right from the start. Wasn't it a sign for how special he was when he was born with two teeth? Which apparently is rather rare and only happens at a chance of 1 in 2000.
Yeah, I bet you his wet nurse wasn't too thrilled about how special he was. Ow. Born with teeth.
But that's not the only reason why people thought he was truly a miracle. So when he was born in 1638, his parents, that's King Louis XIII and Anna of Austria, had been married for over 20 years, and Anna had suffered from at least 4 stillbirths, and nobody believed that she would be able to give birth to a healthy child, an heir to the French throne, and male, of course, at best. But there he was, Louis, not yet the 14th, because obviously he wasn't the king yet, but they did give him the middle name Dieudonné, so the God-given. When the Dauphin, that's, you know, the title of the French heirs to the thrones. So when he was 4 years old, his father died, which made him the new king of France. But of course, a 4-year-old can't rule a country all by himself. And so his mother Anna became the regent pro tempore until Louis would be old enough to take over the state's business. Fun fact here, King Louis XIII had actually changed his will shortly before he died because he didn't want Anna to become regent contrary to tradition. He thought that Anna would not be capable of making political decisions, so he wanted a regent council to be formed to rule France for his heir. He did, however, make Anna head of said council, and when Louis died and Anna was informed of His Majesty's will, she was absolutely not having it. She managed to get the will annulled, and she got some of her husband's ministers and advisors exiled. So in the end, Anna became sole regent of France until 1651, when Louis had officially reached the age of maturity, which was at 13. Now, I could go on and on about the life of the Sun King, life at Versailles, the wars, the political decisions he made in his life, his love life, his affairs, his marriages. But that's, of course, not the topic of this episode. We want to talk about surgeries. And as I mentioned before, Louis was born bitoothal, so to say. But of course, as he grew older, the rest came in, and ultimately he had a full set of teeth. Hooray! Now, we all know that dental hygiene wasn't as advanced back in the day. I mean, not only the dental hygiene, all kind of hygiene was a bit neglected. Like, water was seen as somewhat poisonous because it contained dangerous germs. Mm. They were not completely wrong, though, but I mean, no. You could take a bath, but yeah.
Yeah.
The overwhelming smell of unwashed bodies was covered up by perfume. Unwashed and greasy hair was artfully piled up and powdered, and little bags of herbs and flowers were carried around at all times so you could bury your nose in it whenever some extreme stink crossed your path.
Extreme stink.
You remember how we talked about King Henry VIII and his festering wounds that must have smelled absolutely vile?
Fester, fester, fester. Yeah. And I think it's always difficult then, because then you just end up with like two competing strong smells. So then you get like festering wound, but also chrysanthemums. No, thank you. No.
And sometimes it's not a leg wound. Sometimes it's a bad tooth that is responsible for the bad odor. As it was in King Louis XIV's case. The fear of water, bad dental hygiene procedures, and an abundance of sweets and fruits caused the royal teeth to happily rot away.
Yeah. That's a good way to lose them.
For his toothache, he was often prescribed a remedy made of thyme and chanterelle essence, which is, I mean, I get the thyme, but chanterelle, I never heard of that
Is that a mushroom, chanterelle?
It's a mushroom, yeah, but I never heard that it's supposed to help with your tooth pain.
Yeah, I would have thought clove, but maybe clove wasn't a thing yet. Yeah.
Also, this remedy was unfortunately so strong that it would often burn the king's gum. But it seemed to help in the beginning. In 1677, it wasn't helping so much anymore. The king complained of unbearable toothache. His cheek was swollen, his gum was partially swollen, and the stench when he opened his mouth was extraordinarily bad. Toothache and intense headache are truly the worst for me. Like, all pain that is too close to the brain it's just the worst.
The worst. I never used to be afraid of the dentist. I never loved it, but you just had to go. But since getting the constant migraine, like since I have a headache every single day, I really do kind of have dental anxiety now, which I didn't used to. It's the worst. It's so painful.
Mm-hmm. So Louis was in excruciating pain, the so-called court teeth operator. That's a title. Took a look and found that the king had a festering abscess.
I've heard they're rarely painful. I've never had a dental abscess, knock wood, but I've heard.
Yeah. I never had one, but I know people who have. It's
same.
Horrible.
Seems like agony. Yeah.
The tooth, I think it was one of his right molars. I think, I'm not sure if up or low. Anyway, it got pulled, which must have been such a relief.
Oh, yeah.
Over time, the king had more and more teeth pulled. I don't even think that all of them were removed because they had to be removed, but probably they were also thought to be the cause of other illnesses the king suffered from. You know, like, I mean, we know that bad teeth can be responsible for many things that happen in your body.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so they removed his teeth. And at one point, while once more removing three teeth at a time, the court teeth operator, I just love the title, he broke and pulled a piece of the king's jaw out, which was part of his palate. And now there was this huge gaping hole where minutes before the roof of the king's mouth had been.
No. Mm-mm. This is nightmare fuel for me.
I mean, really? You call it nightmare fuel. I call it the ultimate palate cleanser. But
it's cold.
I'm sure the court teeth operator was completely shocked, but told the king, it's fine. It's fine. No biggie.
It's fine.
This will heal up in no time.
You look great. It's no problem. Can you imagine? I can't even imagine the fear if you were that person.
Of course, it wasn't fine. And the hole didn't heal. I mean, his bone was fucking gone. There was nothing there, yeah?
Yeah.
You know, the palate, the roof of your mouth is this whole thing that actually separates the mouth and the nose area.
Yeah.
So rumor has it that now whenever King Louis XIV drank something, obviously never water because yuck, the liquid would partly come out through his nose again.
Yeah, I believe that rumor.
Now, as fascinating as this story is, I need to add one thing. Historians are still debating if it's even true. Did the king really have a huge hole in his palate and squirt wine through his nose, you know, as kind of the evening entertainment? I want to believe it. It is also said that his surgeon tried to kind of fill up that hole, probably with chewing gum or something like that.
Just a hanky. Clean hanky.
Just hold it there.
Yeah, it's fine.
Apparently he was semi-successful. But even if all that isn't true, the fact that over time King Louis did eventually have all his teeth pulled is true. Being invited to dinner at Versailles must have been fun. I mean, watching the king gulp down some pheasant pâté, only to wash it down with some red wine, which then starts to come back out through his nostrils. I mean, what a sight to see.
No, no, absolutely not. This episode is making my skin crawl. This is my worst nightmare. And I kind of had a similar issue when I had my tonsils and adenoids out in my 20s. So it's that thing where, yeah, every sip of water would just come out my nose immediately when you first get your adenoids out, because your swallowing mechanism just gets all confused. Mm. So I was shoving tissues. My sister and I had a great time trying to figure out if the smallest tampons would work to just get one up each nostril. It was such a hassle to try to stay. You have to drink anyway. What a memory to relive. I can't remember most of my birthday parties, but that memory I will have forever. It lives rent-free for the rest of my life, so...
Yay.
But the difference is that if you're at court and you have to watch that spectacle, you have to be like kind of...
You have to just pretend nothing just happened.
You look so good.
You shoot wine out your nose like nobody's business, Your Highness.
Maybe it was at one of these dinners when allegedly a cardinal told the Sun King, quote, "Ah, sire, teeth. Nobody has teeth anymore." Quote.
So last season. He should have just had a servant like chew his food for him and then baby bird him. You're the royal chewer.
This is a fun episode. I'm sorry that we're laughing about him.
Obviously, yeah. They know.
By the way, King Louis loved to eat. A meal at Versailles usually consisted of 20 to 30 courses, and his sister-in-law said about the king, quote, "He could eat 4 plates of soup, a whole pheasant, a partridge in a pear tree, a large plate of salad, 2 slices of ham, mutton en jus with garlic, a plate of pastry, all followed by fruit and hard-boiled eggs," end quote.
So, I'm not judging, but I do feel that the boiled eggs seem a course too far. It's too many.
Where's the cheese?
I know. Typical dessert fare, pastry, sweet fruit, and then, of course, the hard-boiled eggs. Like, who ends a meal with a hard-boiled egg? I hate how that's the thing I'm most bothered by, but here we are.
So in the end, Louis XIV didn't die of anything caused by his teeth, but he did probably die of something that was caused by his huge appetite. He died from gangrene in his left leg. So gangrene is when body tissue dies because of a lack of proper blood supply. It can happen in any body part, but it very often starts in the toes or fingers. And it's often caused by infection or injuries. Smoking can play a huge factor. It did with my grandfather, who lost both legs. Another thing that can increase the risk of gangrene is diabetes. So shortly before his 77th birthday, the king started to complain about unbearable pain in his left foot. And the doctors couldn't find anything that could have caused it, but they tried different things, and then they figured that massaging the leg was the only thing that would take the pain away for a while. So they kept massaging the leg until they saw that the king's toes first developed a sore and then started to turn black. So that's not good.
Yeah.
The surgeon was called and he wanted to save the king by amputating, but the head physician at court, that was a man named Guy Chrysophago, didn't allow it. He started to treat the king with bath in warm donkey milk and red wine.
I'm sorry. Can we just pause really quickly? Because I want to make sure that we don't just skim right past the baths of warm donkey milk mixed with wine. Warm donkey milk. I bet he had really soft skin, though.
Oi.
So yeah, soon they realized it would have been really smart to have the surgeon take care of it, but now it was too late, and the king died a slow and painful death. He passed on 1st of September 1715, 4 days shy of his 77th birthday. Apparently his last advice to his grandson and heir, future King Louis XV, was, quote, "My son, I might have lived a better life, profit from my errors, and remember this, kings die like other men," end quote. Fun fact, even though Louis XV was also called the Well-Beloved, he in fact was not that well-liked by his people at all. He should have listened to his grandfather and learned from his mistakes. But when do we ever really listen to our ancestors, right? Okay, so one last thing about Louis XIV. As customary for French king, his body was undergoing an autopsy after his death. They found that the king's stomach was twice the size of that of an average man. I really do see a lot of similarities between him and Henry VIII.
So many, so many. Just that success leading to excess, and you can never have enough of anything. It's all over the top. No moderation whatsoever.
No moderation is true, yeah. Also, I think type 2 diabetes sounds really like something that could have been responsible for the gangrene here. His heart was embalmed and then placed to rest in the Église des Jésuites in Paris, as it was tradition. And this next part is an excerpt from an article titled "The Huge Appetite of Louis XIV and the Scientist Who Ate His Mummified Heart."
Spoiler alert.
And I found it on Ripley's.com. Quote, "During the French Revolution, the Sun King's heart was stolen, and it ended up in the possession of Lord Harcourt, the Archbishop of York. The story goes that William Buckland visited Harcourt in 1848 and learned of the mummified heart. He reportedly couldn't resist the taste, so he gobbled it up. It's unclear whether he asked permission to eat it or simply swallowed it on impulse."
Oh my God.
"His behavior wasn't out of the ordinary for the scientist, who was so obsessed with strange food that he vowed to eat a piece of every single creature from the animal kingdom. And the heart of a king was apparently too good to pass up." End quote.
Wow.
Wow, right?
Yeah. Can you imagine the audacity?
I mean, he didn't even ask permission.
I bet he
didn't. I love the part where he said he gobbled it up. Like, imagine somebody comes to your house and says, "Look, I have the mummified heart of a French king here." And then the person just takes it and swallows it whole.
They just grab a hold of it, like when Opus gets on a paper towel and takes off running around. Like, "It's mine now, motherfucker. Good luck. I'm going to eat this right in front of you." Oh, boy.
So, as always, when it comes to these kind of topics, I just could go on and on and on and on, but I think that's enough, and now it's Annie's turn.
All right. So, in King Louis XIV's case, it was somebody else who did the dental surgeries, but what happens when it's the surgeon operating on himself? This has happened several times, probably more times than we know of, but we're going to tell you about the time when Dr. Evan O'Neill Kane operated on himself, and not just once. Evan O'Neill Kane was born on April 6, 1861, in Derby, Pennsylvania, so he was born 6 days before the Civil War broke out on the 12th of April, 1861. And that takes us to Evan's father, Thomas L. Kane. Oh, and by the way, you might remember Elijah Kent Kane, the Arctic explorer and maybe terrible husband to Margaret Fox of the Fox sisters. We discussed that in episodes 142 and 143. Elijah Kane and Thomas Kane were brothers. I feel like there's a lot of connections to other episodes lately.
Yeah, true.
So I'm not going to talk too much about Thomas L. Kane, and I'm just going to tell you how Wikipedia describes him. Quote, "He was an American attorney, abolitionist, philanthropist, and military officer who was influential in the Western migration of the Latter-day Saint movement and served as a Union Army colonel and general of volunteers in the American Civil War. He received a brevet promotion to major general for gallantry at the Battle of Gettysburg." End quote.
That's a lot for one life.
It's too much. It's all really impressive, though. I mean, I don't know how people get that much done.
Right, I'm so happy and proud when I can fold my laundry and put it away and look at this guy.
I fold the laundry, it's the putting it away that I struggle with. Anyway, so apparently he was a personal friend of Brigham Young, and he was sort of a mediator between the Church of Latter-day Saints and the U.S. government. He played an important part in de-escalating the Utah War and helping Utah to gain statehood. And then after the Civil War had started, Thomas Kane told his wife, Elizabeth Wood Kane, who had just given birth to Evan, that he was off to fight in the war. You see, as we mentioned in the wiki quote I just read, he was a very passionate abolitionist and he saw it as his duty to fight to end slavery. So he told his wife and his three children goodbye. He recruited some hardworking men in western Pennsylvania who knew how to use a rifle, and together they built three log rafts and floated down the Susquehanna River to Harrisburg, where they enrolled. The regiment Thomas Kane had formed was the 42nd Pennsylvania Regiment, or 13th Pennsylvania Reserve. They were also commonly referred to as bucktails because the men liked to decorate their hats with deer tails. He fought in the Civil War until it ended in 1865, even after he had been wounded by a bullet that knocked out some of his teeth and negatively influenced his vision. During the war, he was promoted several times. After the Battle of Gettysburg, he was Brevet Major General. After the war was over, he returned to his wife and kids. They had one more son in 1863, and then the family moved to western Pennsylvania, where he helped to found the city of Kane. So, wow. And that's just his father. Evan's mother is not any less impressive. Elizabeth Denniston Wood Kane was a writer, philanthropist, women's rights activist, and one of the first students to study at the Female Medical College of Pennsylvania. She worked as a physician until her death in 1909, and she was not the only physician in the family. The youngest son, Thomas Jr., and the daughter, Harriet Amelia, were physicians, just as Evan was. The oldest son, Elijah, was an engineering graduate from Princeton.
Who are these people?
Making all the rest of us look bad. That's who they are.
Overachievers.
Right? Big time. Can you imagine the pressure in that family? Whew. And that's not all. In 1887, Elizabeth and her two sons, Evan and Thomas Jr., founded the Woodside Cottage Hospital in Kane. All right, so I just found all of that really interesting, but now it's time to talk about Evan O'Neill Kane. So, as I said, Evan was born on 6th of April, 1861 in Derby, but he did grow up in Kane after the war, which was the town his father helped to found. Probably inspired by his mother, he studied medicine and began to practice in the 1880s. As I said before, he was a co-founder of the Woodside Cottage Hospital. Now, the idea of the hospital was actually his father's, and he was convinced that all kinds of wounds would heal better in the healthy Kane air. Unfortunately, Thomas L. Kane died in 1883, so 4 years before the hospital was opened. Evan married in 1893, and the couple had a son in 1894. Unfortunately, but not uncommon at the time, his wife, Blanche Rupert, died 2 weeks later. Evan married a second time, and his second wife was Lila Rupert, Blanche's sister. I know it seems a little bit weird for us nowadays to imagine marrying a sibling of a deceased spouse, but back then, and even today, I don't think it's that uncommon. Certainly back then, it was very common.
Very common.
Yeah.
More common, I think, that brothers married the widow of the brother or something like that. That was rather common, yeah.
That was pretty common, yeah, because it was seen as taking care of, you were going to continue to take care of your family, basically, you know? So the couple had 6 children, a girl and 5 boys, including a set of twins. That's a lot of kids.
So many.
Right. I mean, not really for that time, but that feels like a lot. Evan worked at the hospital that his family had founded, but he was also very curious to try new procedures and to learn more about medicine. So in 1898, he started to work as a railway surgeon while also keeping his position at the hospital. Now, what's a railway surgeon, you might ask? Railway surgeons were doctors who worked for railway companies in order to treat their workers, who were building and maintaining the railroad throughout the land. There is a whole page dedicated to spreading information about railroad doctors. It's called railwaysurgery.org, and it is fascinating. Go take a look at their page. And they describe railway surgery as follows, quote, "Railroad surgeons formed a unique medical specialty operating a vast and innovative network of railroad hospitals and clinics. Nearly forgotten today, this relatively small but dedicated group of doctors made many advances in medical science and embraced an innovative payment system now used by many health insurance plans. As the 19th century unfolded, few employers offered employee benefit packages. Most workers had to secure medical care at their own expense. Some large industrial companies, particularly in the mining, lumber, and steel industries, began to provide healthcare to employees during the mid-19th century. The large number of injuries and the remote location of many work sites in the railroad industry led railroads to adopt similar plans. One surgeon reported that in 1897, 1,693 railroad workers were killed and 27,667 were injured. The opening of the transcontinental rail line and subsequent westward migration brought large numbers of people to remote areas devoid of doctors or hospitals, creating a crisis for those in need of medical attention. The earliest recorded railway surgeon may have been an individual known as the railroad doctor, whose name is now lost, working for the Erie Railroad in 1849. By the early 20th century, every major railroad listed full-time doctors on its payroll. Railroads divided the cost of these services, charging employees a fixed amount by payroll deduction, while the company funded the rest. Some charged a flat rate to all employees, while others scaled the cost based on salary. Most lines mandated participation, and many employees objected to the imposition. At a time when many people rarely, if ever, saw a doctor, the need for medical coverage must have appeared less than compelling. Surgical historian Ira Rutkow, M.D., noted that the early railway medical plans formed an important cause of labor strife. Over time, however, more workers accepted the plans, sometimes even requesting them. Statistics on the plant system in 1896 show that 98% of workers participated in the voluntary program. End quote. So,
it's really interesting.
It really is. Yeah. Working for the railway, building the tracks in the middle of nowhere, this was all dangerous jobs. There were a lot of accidents and a lot of people died because of it. The doctors often had to perform surgery in very unsanitary environments, and they had to make do with what they had. It's a bit like battle surgeons with patients suffering from similar wounds, but in battles, you're looking at bullet wounds or lost limbs because of explosion. With railway surgeons, they were mostly facing wounds from falls, crushed bodies, and body parts that had been mangled or torn off. Of course, wounds from explosion applied in both instances. This kind of trauma surgery was fascinating for Evan Kane, and in just a few years, he worked for 5 different railroad companies and performed over 1,000 surgeries. And of course, this medical field was in dire need of some inventions and innovations that would make the job of a railway surgeon a little bit easier. For example, surgeons used to calmly talk while operating to help keep the patient calm, so went the theory. But obviously, in stressful situations, doctors would not be able to calmly chat away, so Evan would play music with his phonograph. He was a big proponent of musical therapy for recovering patients and believed that music could help reduce the patient's pain level. He was a pioneer and great inventor in the medical field. He made changes to the Murphy button, which was a brilliant device created by another equally brilliant medical mind, Dr. Benjamin Murphy. This device was most commonly used for the surgery I had back in 2019, when your gallbladder is removed. This device would be sewn into your gallbladder and your intestines. It would sort of connect the two. And it made the surgery 10 times faster. And the less time the patient was open on the table or in the field, the better chance for success. The button was also used in the surgery that I had last November to remove part of my intestine. And in this case, they would remove the problematic part of the intestine and then reattach the two sides using the button. What Kane did was he had lost, unfortunately, a patient to a blockage after using the button. And so he took a serious look at it and improved it by widening the diameter of the opening. This was used into the 1930s when staples would replace it. In 1900, Kane met with the American Academy of Railway Surgeons, where he talked about the many issues facing surgeons working in the field rather than in a hospital setting, and he focused on the difficulty of getting fluid back into a patient after hemorrhage causes the veins to collapse. He presented this device to use multiple subcutaneous injections. Getting subcutaneous fluid is, I think it's more common in our pets, right? It's when they give you fluid under the skin rather than giving you fluid into a vein. If you've ever had a dog, or maybe they do it with cats, but our dog had a few dogs we've had over the years have had the occasional serious problems with vomiting, right? And they'll give them a subcutaneous infusion and they come home with sort of a camel hump that gets slowly, steadily reabsorbed by the body. But for emergencies, generally you wouldn't use this type of rehydration, right? It wouldn't be efficient enough, but it was much better than nothing when you were facing collapsed veins. His device could hold up to 10 needles, but apparently he found 4 was enough. And the use of 2 sites for subcutaneous infusion is still used today. And the headband with the light on it that surgeons use, Well, I mean, back then it wasn't a light bulb, but instead an acetylene torch just strapped to your forehead. And that would help you see better into an open wound on a patient. He's also responsible for that. And then the other thing he did, this is just a quote from Wikipedia because it's so interesting, but I'm not going to paraphrase it all. So I'm just going to tell you from Wikipedia. Quote, Kane had some novel ideas on materials for use in surgery. Influenced by his work in railway surgery, he was particularly concerned with materials that were good for use in the field and sometimes advocated the use of supplies that could be obtained locally from hardware stores and similar suppliers. He made his own bandages from woven asbestos, a material readily available at the time. Sterilizing dressings and keeping them sterilized was a problem in the field. Unlike modern dressings, which are supplied in sealed, sterile packs, the dressings of the time had to be sterilized immediately before use. In an emergency situation, there may be little time to do this. The use of fireproof bandages allowed them to be sterilized quickly in an open fire. In 1924, Kane proposed the use of mica to repair head wounds that had been exposed and damaged the brain. He cited among the advantages of this that it provided a window for the physician to observe the damage, and in an emergency in the field, mica could be obtained by removing it from a stove window, an application for which it was commonly used at the time. End quote.
Wow.
Right? He was very... He was like the MacGyver of surgery,
yeah,
sort of.
Very hands-on.
Mm. Yeah.
MacGyver of surgery, it's true. Yeah.
Right? And then this last thing I thought, this is also from the wiki, but I knew you'd like this. Not like this, but appreciate the weirdness of it. Quote, Kane advocated and practiced tattooing newborn infants in an inconspicuous place with an identifying mark matching an identical tattoo on the mother. Kane was aware of cases where claims had been made of babies being mixed up and wished to avoid any possibility of this occurring in his hospital. In Kane's view, complex clerical systems designed to prevent errors that might be implemented in a large hospital were impractical in a small hospital because the administrative staff to run it were simply not available. Kane also argued that it was impossible to positively prove that a mistake had not been made with a purely clerical system. End quote. Yeah.
I think I prefer the wristband.
Right? You don't want just where bottom of the feet, maybe?
Behind the ear?
I don't know. I feel like labor and delivery is hard enough on everyone. And then they're like, here, have a tattoo.
What if the mothers had, like, several kids, like they all had, and then...
Yeah.
You have like 10 tattoos.
That's how sleeves started, Johanna. You didn't know? All right. Some of his ideas were a little bit more outlandish, though. In later years, he would tattoo the letter K in Morse code next to the incisions he had made, which is, I don't like that. It's like an artist signing his work, right?
I just wanted to say he signed his work.
Yeah. I mean, also fair enough, I guess. But I don't know. He also thought that it was too risky to give general anesthesia, and he wanted to prove that for some surgeries, a local anesthesia was sufficient. And of course, today we know that that's true. Every general anesthesia has some risks, and of course, nowadays, general anesthesia is way safer than back then and can be administered much more smoothly, and it's more precise and exact. But back then, risk was significantly higher, and they used ether and chloroform. One of the most famous examples of that is Dr. John Snow. We've talked about him before, who used ether and chloroform on Queen Victoria when she gave birth to her eighth child in 1853.
Can you even imagine all those surgeries that had to be performed before general or later local anesthesia was available? I mean, that's pure horror.
Yeah, that is legitimate going through hell. It's awful.
Mm.
And yeah, general anesthesia was a godsend, but it was also way too much for smaller surgeries. And that became crystal clear in 1848 when 15-year-old Hannah Greener was troubled by an ingrown toenail. The following statement was given by her surgeon and printed in several newspapers. This particular article is from the Bath Chronicle, Bath, England, 10th of February, 1848, page 4. Quote, Thomas Nathaniel Megason, surgeon, having been duly cautioned and asked if he wished to make any statement, said Hannah Greener died under my hands on Friday while under the influence of chloroform, which I had given her for the purpose of producing insensibility during the operation of removing the toenail. She never complained of pain in the chest to me. The pain in her toes might cause her to become thinner. I seated her in a chair and put about a teaspoonful of chloroform into a tablecloth and held it to her nose. After she had drawn her breath twice, she pulled my hand down. I told her to draw her breath naturally, which she did, and in about half a minute I observed the muscles of the arms become rigid and her breathing a little quickened. I had my hand on her pulse, which was natural, until the muscles became rigid. It then appeared somewhat weaker, not altered in frequency. I then told Mr. Lloyd, my assistant, to begin the operation, which he did, and took the nail off. When the semicircular insertion was made, she gave a struggle or a jerk, which I thought was from the chloroform not having taken sufficient effect. I did not apply any more. Her eyes were closed, and I opened them, and they remained open. Her mouth was open, and her lips and face blanched. When I opened her eyes, they were congested. I called for water when I saw her face was blanched, and I dashed some of it into her face. It had no effect. I then gave her some brandy, a little of which she swallowed with difficulty. I then laid her down on the floor and attempted to bleed her in the arm and jugular vein, but only obtained about a spoonful. She was dead, I believe, at the time I attempted to bleed her. The last time I felt her pulse was immediately previous to the blanched appearance coming on and when she gave the jerk. The time would not be more than 3 minutes from her first inhaling the chloroform till her death. I purchased the chloroform from Messrs. Daglish and Ismay of Newcastle. I have used chloroform from the same place before with good effect and with no ill consequences. I did not apply more than a dram to the deceased, probably less. One person I gave it to required upwards of half an ounce at 4 repetitions before she became insensible, and she completely recovered afterward. I have used it to a person who was very drunk and had dislocated and fractured his ankle. 2 spoonfuls were given in that case, and they had the desired effect, as he would not lie still without it. Mr. Lloyd, who was present with me in the case of the deceased, is a regularly educated medical man, and he has also been in the habit of using chloroform. End quote. So that's really sad, and I feel a lot of empathy for that child and her family, obviously, but also very much for the doctor. You can see how upset he is by this loss of a patient and him trying to make sense of how it could have happened when so much more had been used on others. But even today, you know, anesthesia can be fatal, especially if you have an allergy to something, you know? But we can also see there was a dire need for a less severe form of anesthesia that would only numb the part that was being operated on.
I'm sure King Louis XIV would have enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, he definitely would. And finally, in 1860, the German chemist Albert Niemann distilled a substance from coca leaves in an attempt that was made before. But Niemann was the one who was really able to extract the purest essence of those coca leaves, and of course, today we know this substance as cocaine. Now, cocaine has a numbing property, and so doctors started to experiment with it as a local anesthetic. But it would not be until 1884 when Dr. Karl Kohler, an Austrian, performed the first surgery with cocaine as local anesthetic on an eye. In 1905, a new discovery replaced the highly addictive cocaine, which was Novocaine or Procaine. And I imagine so did the popularity at the dentist. Did it get, I don't know, do you think cocaine initially kept people from coming back? Like, boy, I just have the slightest touch right?
Yeah, maybe. But then on the other hand, they could get cocaine in all funny kind of things, like cough syrup.
You're right. Yeah. All right, now back to Evan O'Neill Kane. In 1919, his little finger on his left hand was infected and needed to be amputated, and this was the perfect opportunity to show how local anesthesia for this kind of procedure was superior. He simply performed the amputation on himself, no biggie. But honestly, amputating your own finger is impressive and all, but not impressive enough. Evan wanted to prove that local anesthesia was also sufficient for bigger surgeries, surgeries that might involve some of your organs, and the perfect opportunity would soon present itself, when it was time to have his appendix removed. Now, to be very clear here, Evan was a skilled, very skilled, and experienced surgeon. Some sources say he had done around 4,000 appendectomies, but he didn't dare use Novocaine as a local anesthetic on one of his patients first. So he volunteered to try out the procedure on himself. You gotta respect that, right? Like, I'm not using this on a patient until I myself know that it works.
Yeah.
The sources are a little bit contradictory here. Some say that he did not, in fact, need an appendectomy. He just wanted to try out and see how it worked. And others say he did need to have his appendix removed, so he decided to take a chance. What do you think?
I'm not 100% sure, but I think he didn't need one. Maybe he needed one, but not that urgent. And he just wanted to finally try it on himself, you know, so that he could use the procedure on his patients. I mean, usually, especially back then, especially back in those days, the need of an appendectomy would come up rather sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this surgery was scheduled way ahead of time and very well prepared.
Yeah, I agree. I think so too. So on the 15th of February, 1921, Evan O'Neill Kane was lying on the operating table. He's all propped up by pillows. A mirror was placed so that he could see what he was doing, and he started to remove his appendix. It's probably another sign, isn't it, that the surgery was well prepared ahead of time because he had had to practice movements with the help of a mirror, right? I mean, he did this surgery thousands of times, but now he's looking at it upside down and mirrored.
Yeah.
I can't put eyeliner on.
Can you imagine? Wow. These people are impressive.
Right? Yeah. So he injected the Novocaine, and once he was numb, he started to cut into his abdomen, just joking and chatting and slicing. His younger brother, Thomas Jr., was there. He's watching the surgery, and once Evan had successfully removed the appendix, Thomas took over and stitched his brother back up. This is from the Daily Record, Long Branch, New Jersey, February 16, 1921, page 3. Quote, surgeon removes his own appendix. Dr. Evan Kane sends word that he is getting along all right. Kane, Pennsylvania, February 16th. Dr. Evan O'Neill Kane, the 60-year-old surgeon of the place who late yesterday removed his own appendix in one of the most remarkable surgical operations on record, spent a comparatively easy night and sent word from his bedside today that he is further on the road to recovery than is usual the day following an operation for the removal of the appendix. Quote, just say that I am getting along all right, said the doctor to his nurse. Maybe a little later I will have a statement that will be of interest. It was stated that Dr. Kane, since the operation, has dictated a number of letters and given directions regarding the conduct of his personal affairs and practice. End quote.
He just couldn't stop working. Also, if for our listeners out there, I know I mentioned it at least once already. If you've seen the Nick, then you know. I'm not going to say more. I'm not going to spoil it for others. But this surgery kind of plays a part in the second season.
So the surgery was a full success, and indeed Dr. Kane did make a quick recovery. We have photos of him operating on himself. It's surreal. They're cool.
Mm.
It wasn't the last time that Dr. Kane would operate on himself. In 1932, he operated on a hernia that was caused by a horse riding accident 6 years prior. And again, the surgery went well, even though it was a way more risky surgery due to the fact that he could easily puncture an artery. But after an hour and 55 minutes, he was done. 36 hours later, he was back to operating on his patients. Some people, though, accused Evan of being vain and a show-off, that the hernia surgery on himself was not necessary as he had proven his point already, and that it should have been done by another surgeon. He was just a surgical hotshot, really.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
Yeah. Also, this time he didn't recover so easily. He was 70 years old at the time, and his health would never recover back to normal. There were some other private troubles that might have contributed to his declining health. In 1931, his firstborn son, Elisha Kane, the son from his first marriage, was accused of murdering his wife. She had died in a drowning accident while on a trip to Chesapeake, Virginia. The whole trial was a huge spectacle at the time. It was the son of a very prominent family with so many remarkable family members, and here he was accused of murdering his wife. But this is a story for another episode. We don't want to tell you what happened just yet. So Evan O'Neill Kane died on April 1st, 1932 due to pneumonia and was laid to rest in Kane, Pennsylvania. And I also want to mention that Dr. Kane was not the only person who performed an appendectomy on himself. There is another very famous case that we, of course, have to mention, and that is the famous case of Dr. Leonid Rogozov. He also cut out his own appendix, but contrary to Dr. Kane, he didn't have a lot of time to prepare himself for it. He was on an Antarctic expedition that lasted from September of 1960 through October of 1962, and his assignment was that of a doctor for the 13 researchers at Novolazarevskaya Station, located near the Antarctic coast. On the morning of the 29th of April, 1961, Leonid woke up feeling weak and suffering from nausea and running a fever. It soon became apparent he was suffering from appendicitis and he needed to undergo surgery ASAP. Unfortunately, they were in the middle of a blizzard, and it was just one of those days where everything is so fucked up nobody could do anything, so the decision was made that he had to be operated right there and then at the Antarctic station. But that's a bit of a problem when you're the only doctor at the Antarctic station. So Rogozov was like, okay, it's fine. I'm just going to do what needs to be done. Everything was set up for surgery. He appointed people to aid him during the surgery. One was an engineer, the other a meteorologist, so that sounds ideal. Just like Kane, he was propped up with pillows and a mirror was placed so he could see the incision. And then he injected himself with the local anesthetic and waited until he was numb. Then he began to cut into his abdomen. I think the anesthesia didn't work fully because Rogozov was quoted in several newspaper articles of being in pain during the procedure.
Oh, Jesus, can you imagine?
Yeah. Yeah. It makes me think of, I have a few girlfriends who needed emergency C-sections and the epidural didn't take. That's what I keep thinking of. But he did. He managed to take out the infected part and stitched everything back up in a little under 2 hours, even though he had to take several breaks because of weakness and nausea. A few weeks later, he was reported as being back on his feet and able to work again. When asked how he managed to go through the surgery, even though he was in pain and it was hard for him to see, he answered that he liked to lift weights. And that really helped him a lot in that moment. Okay. So after his recovery, he was awarded the Order of the Red Banner of Labor, and extensive health checks were put into place for people who were applying for similar expeditions.
But first of all, badass.
Yeah.
And second of all, extensive health checks should have been in place for people who travel to the Antarctica.
Right. Agreed.
But also, I think an appendicitis could happen. I mean, he's been there for 9 months already at that time, so...
Yeah, I'm not sure they would have caught it, even if they'd done a,
Exactly.
Yeah. I agree. And that's it for today. Three moments in history that involved fresh hell kind of surgeries. That episode was gross.
But interesting. Yeah. In a gross way.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. All right.
Do we have something good? Something good that we don't have to cut our own appendix out, for example?
Yeah.
I have something good.
Good.
I've been to the drive-in movie for the first time in my life. That's
so exciting.
Not a big thing here in Austria. We have like one drive-in. It's close to Vienna in whole of Austria. And it was actually, it went bankrupt a couple of years back and it reopened. And I really, really wanted to go. And so we went on Sunday. And we watched the new Baz Luhrmann movie, Elvis. And I had so much fun. Like, it's the best thing ever. I love it. Like you have this app that you need to download on your phone and then you can order food and they bring it to your car directly. And it was so much fun.
That's awesome.
Like it was perfect. In 2 weeks, they're going to play Grease.
Nice.
So we might go there. I'm not sure yet.
Nice.
But yeah, I really, really enjoyed it.
I love the drive-in. Absolutely love it. There's one on Cape Cod that we used to go to regularly. Still do. Yeah. Super fun.
Do you have something good?
My something good is actually, modern medical science.
Mm.
I feel like that's been one in the past, but just a lot of people in my life are having pretty serious medical issues right now. And I'm just really grateful for how far we've come when it comes to medical science. So my something good is science. Yay.
That's really good. Yay, science.
Yay, science.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of our other episodes, please do us the huge, huge favor. Go to your podcast app and check if you can leave us a rating and or review. It really helps us out a lot. Not only does it help other listeners to find our podcast who might have similar taste, but it also helps us to keep going because your reviews are amazing. You can visit our webpage where you find links to everything, links to our merch store. We have Halloween merch with some spooky fuckery shirts. You find a link to Patreon. Patreon game night will be on 30th of September before the podcast awards. Talking about the podcast awards, we will set up a group chat for viewing the awards together. Details will follow. I just have to figure out the technicalities. We did it last year, but I'm just trying to figure out if I can improve something.
Yeah.
Please join our Facebook group. It's fantastic. Really. I love it. Best people out there.
The best group of people. Yeah.
Don't forget to send us your Halloween stories, please, to freshhellpodcast@gmail.com. You have until the end of September. We're really looking forward to reading them. Please tell your pets we said hi. We miss them. We love them. Hug them, cuddle them. Give them all the best treats, the best part of the meat from your table. They're the best pets. Be kind to them. Be kind to others. And most importantly, be kind to yourself. And that's the hardest part of it all.
It really is. And if you yourself are going through hell,
keep going. Tschüss.
Bye.